four in the first one.
All right, good to see we're packing them in like we usually do. So, two things. Three things. Thing number one, unfortunately, I haven't had a chance to really get too far with the papers. Personal crises, and I just didn't have time to sit at my computer. But over the next couple of days, I will be sitting down, and you will start dribs and drabs hearing from me with how you did. And like I said, I'll include the metrics for your final exam. So again, I apologize. I had intentions of like spending yesterday doing it, but yesterday got screwed up. Saturday got screwed up. Sunday got screwed up. So I will get them done before the end of the semester. Second, I am not going to be here on Thursday. So our last class session, and it is class session because that's number three. I screwed up the calendar. Our last class session, there will be a video that will be engaged that you'll have to watch to get the last information for the final exam. Our final exam will be on the last day of the semester, which is Tuesday, not Thursday. I had set it at Thursday because I had a conversation with the registrar back in like January because the calendar was all screwed up and he said it was Thursday. But apparently that was wrong. So thanks for correcting me. You actually did kind of mention it. But so your final exam will be on Tuesday. It will be in Engage, it will be remote, and it will be open all day. So it will open up at 8 a.m. and it will close at 11:59 p.m. Yes.
So today is our last in-person?
With me, yes.
Okay.
I am going to record a video picking up where I leave off just to finish because the exam's already done and I got to get through all the stuff. So I will do that today and I'll just post it in Engage and you can watch it whenever you want to watch it before Tuesday.
So we don't have a Thursday class?
Literally, that's just what I just said, yes.
I'm just clarifying.
Yeah, I know. I don't blame
you. I like to clarify, because I always end up being wrong.
Oh, welcome to my world.
So there's no Thursday class, and there's no Tuesday class.
Well, technically, yes.
Well, on
you have to watch a video for Thursday, and you have to take your exam on Tuesday.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, here in this building.
No, you can be anywhere you want. If you want to take the exam here in this building, be my guest. But I will not be here. Okay. And again, I apologize for confusion. Again, it's so just so you know, the last couple of years, the college has constantly changed the way they're doing the calendars. And every single semester, it's been something different. And it's just been really confusing. So this semester, it was different than last spring. Last spring, like, all the underclassmen stayed 3 days longer than the seniors. Well, this year now, apparently, everyone's leaving. So it's just going to go with the flow. But at the end of the day for you, it was not going to make a difference because I probably was not going to have a class on Tuesday anyways because I'm really at the end of the information. So, but whatever. So I will send an email, an announcement, because obviously half the class isn't here. Just so everybody knows where we're at. So just put it in your head. There'll be a video in Engage. And then you will have to take your exam on Tuesday. Okay? Okay. All right. Got to finish the American War for Independence. Don't have much left. And then we're going to talk about the beginning of the French Revolution. So we know this war started because of other wars. And really one of the big issues was over taxation. And the colonists themselves believed in those English rights, which became popular because of the Glorious Revolution. See, that's the way history works. If you are ignorant to history, nothing in today's world should really make sense to you. Because we are where we are today because of what happened yesterday and the day before. And all of these events that we've covered, they've all been intertwined, one influencing the next, influencing the next. So the War for Independence was the consequence of the French and Indian War, which is a consequence of the political dynamic in Europe, because you had some kings being wanting more, 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 and you had other kings wanting them to have less, less, less. But it didn't just start. It was a culmination of events that took place over a decade. And again, we've gave you some of the most popular examples, things that you hopefully remember from high school. You know, the Sons of Liberty protesting laws like the Stamp Act, tarring and feathering, protesting, and outward violence and death. Well,
after Bunker and Breed's Hill, the dynamic in the colonies was very, very different. Because prior to this, the overall consent of most people was that we are British citizens, and we will use our rights, such as the right to assemble, such as the right of free speech, the right to grieve, you know, contact the government and complain, that they were content to use those rights. Well, things changed when people died. And that changed the questions that were being asked. And there were some people in our country that started saying, maybe we no longer can be with the motherland. Maybe we need a divorce. Maybe we need to break away and basically go on our own. Because again, John Locke, the social contract. The government doesn't protect your lives, liberty, and states. It's the right of the people to alter or abolish the government and make a new one. But the danger was, if you go against your government, that's an act of treason. And what's the punishment for treason? What's always the punishment for treason? Death. Historically, every single nation on earth, if you commit an act of treason against the government, you get shot or hung or beheaded or whatever. So these colonists, this was a really serious question. You know, not like the little wokeified kids that are protesting on college campuses, hiding their face behind their masks and protesting with their Coach and Gucci bags. That's not real. This was real. If we do this, we could lose our lives. Our families could be destroyed. Our homes could be burned to the ground. And we could be shot. Are we going to risk it? Well, down in Philadelphia, the colonies would send delegates to gather in a second meeting of what became known as the Continental Congress. The first one took place after Worcester. And the Continental Congress began basically scratching their head, trying to figure out, what should we do? Should we continue to hope the government, the crown, hears our complaints and modifies? Should we reconcile? Should we apologize? Or should we go for broke? But again, even amongst the founding fathers, there was a split. That was until a book was published. Arguably one of the most strongest pieces of propaganda published during this time period. A recent British illegal immigrant, Thomas Paine, and I'm not using that trying to be shocking, he was not allowed under British law to actually come here. He had got himself in some trouble in England, and he was supposed to stay and serve his punishment, but he bailed. He got on a boat and sailed across, trying to avoid the law. But in 1776, he would publish a pamphlet known as Common Sense. Anonymously, he was terrified. He didn't want to get caught. He didn't want the crown to know that he was over in America. But in it, he used the logic of the Enlightenment. Using your reason, your brains, the ability to understand the way things work, to understand the natural law, and then try to suggest alternatives, improvements, progress. In Common Sense, he basically argued that the colonies should declare their independence because being with the crown no longer makes sense. First and foremost, he took a naturalist approach. He said, in his first major argument, that essentially it makes no sense that an island perpetually govern a continent. Again, island, continent. He said it's illogical. The continent should be free. He also pointed out something, and I think in chapter 3 or 4, I forgot where it was exactly, that America was no longer British. By 1776, the colonies were diverse. There wasn't just people from England there anymore. There were Irish, there were Scottish, yes, technically part of the British Empire, but there were also French. There also were Dutch. There were Germans. There were some Spanish. Of course, there were the Indians. You know, why should all of these people be part of the British Empire when they're not actually British by birth, by blood? He was one of the first people to cement the simple notion that America was different. So, one, island, continent, makes no sense. Two, we're diverse, we're not British. And then three, he used history. Again, we didn't have time to go into it, but prior to the War for Independence, there were actually three wars fought in North America, the most famous being the French and Indian Wars, in which England dragged the colonists into war. And England never gave anything to the colonists as a reward. One of the wars, I think it was like the Queen Victoria War or something like that. It happened around like 1715, 1720. The Massachusetts militia actually marched up to Canada and seized Cape Breton Island because there was a big fort up there. They did it without, you know, redcoats. They did it all on their own. They took the island and they planted the Massachusetts colony flag. Well, when France and England were negotiating a settlement for the war, the British basically told the Massachusetts people, go home, you get nothing. And they gave the island back to the French. So the people in Massachusetts were like, what the hell? We fought and we died and then we get nothing? So Paine put his finger on that pulse. And that caused people to say, yeah, we fought the French and Indians, and what did we get? We got a tax bill. That's not right. Oh, and plus, I should also include, they also passed a law that said the English colonists could not go over the Appalachian Mountains. That all the land from the Appalachians to the Mississippi was going to be a big Indian reservation. So the colonists were pissed. And Tommy Paine knew it. So he made that his third argument. So once he laid out his thesis on the table, he concluded with this statement. And I quote, "Volumes have been made on the subject of the struggle between England and America. Men of all ranks have embarked in the controversy from different motives and with various designs. But all have been ineffectual. And the period of debate is closed. Arms, as the last resort, decide the contest. The appeal was the choice of the king, and the continent has accepted the challenge." This book spread like wildfire, and it caused more and more people to basically say, we can't negotiate anymore. We're going to take the great leap. And ultimately, it would be the popularity of common sense that would encourage the Second Continental Congress to create the Committee of Five, which then selected the youngest among them, Thomas Jefferson, to write what became known as the Declaration of Independence. One of the most important documents that, if you read the preamble, is the epitome of the Enlightenment. Oh, plus it's also a big act of plagiarism. It literally is John Locke 101. In it, Thomas Jefferson essentially speaks about the social contract. He says, and I quote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, FYI, Thomas Jefferson intentionally did not use the word property. He did not use property. He used the pursuit of happiness because Jefferson understood that not everybody had property. He felt that Locke's reference to property said that only the rich people should be allowed to own stuff. No, no, no. Jefferson said, no, even the poor people in freedom should be allowed to pursue whatever they want that makes them happy. If they want to get a lot of stuff, they should be allowed to get a lot of stuff. Just FYI. Jefferson also said that governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Social contract. And lastly, that when any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it and institute a new government. The Enlightenment, 101. John Locke, 101. Jefferson's focus was on the here and now. That we should be able to make a better society than what we have. We should progress. We should improve things. And never mind the focus of what happens after you die, which was the traditional mindset. Divine rights of kings, the power of the church, and so forth. He's like, no, 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 no. It's all about the now. Now, of course, was it perfect? Not by today's standards. Yes, women were not included. Children not included. There were slaves. I get it. But the brilliance of Jefferson's statement is that he's talking about perpetually improving. You got to start somewhere. And yes, in our 225 odd years of American history, there's been some bumpy patches. Actually, we're almost 250. Wow, I'm getting old. There's been some bumpy patches along the road, but we're always seeking to be better, which is very different than everywhere else on Earth. So we're probably perfect? No. But we're better than everyone else. We are the exception. All right. So now you got a book that encourages people to think about independence. You have a political statement, which eventually would be ratified by the states and sent to the crown. Why did the people go along with this? Why did they do it? It's one thing to have words, but why risk everything? Well, as I said, they believed in the traditional rights of the English people. The things that we've talked about. The rule of law, trial by jury, habeas corpus, the right to private property. Everything that we've touched upon when we've touched upon English history. The people in the colonies were basically saying, we're not slaves, we're not second-class citizens. We deserve these as well. Plus, if you really look at colonial history, and we used to teach American history here. I don't think we even do anymore, which is sad. But if you look at the colonial period from the foundation of Jamestown in Plymouth all the way up to the Revolution, the colonists, for the most part, were basically governing themselves. Yes, there were incidents where the crown directly interfered, but for the most part, England had its own problems. I mean, think about what we talked about. They had a civil war where they ended up killing their king, and then they had the interregnum, and then they had the Glorious Revolution. England had its own problems to deal with, so the people that were over here became very independent-minded. And they realized, we can actually do this. We don't need the crown over 3,000 miles away. We can make decisions that are good for ourselves. Plus, unlike our society today, which is becoming more and more illiterate, historically speaking, philosophically speaking, most of the people who were literate back then read the books of the Enlightenment. They were reading the words of the philosophers. They could quote Montesquieu and Voltaire. They debated Rousseau. And the people that were alive during this period said, yeah, we have the ability to use our brains and make a better society. And believe it or not, religion played a role too. The people over here largely were not Catholics. Catholics, as we know, because we talked about the Protestant Reformation, are dependent upon the rule of the church. Whereas Protestants, particularly Calvinists, you know, build their faith on a local level and they protect their faiths. So the Puritans, like the Pilgrims, they didn't come over here for religious freedom. No, they came over here to make their own religious communities. Because they did not like what was going on. So to a degree, there's a lot of inherent resistance in Puritanism. And yes, proof if you ever read about Roger Williams, who founded Providence, which would become Rhode Island, or Anne Hutchinson. You know, those were colonists that were actually kicked out of Massachusetts because they didn't preach the religion the right way. Well, the thing about if you have your faith, you're going to do everything to defend the faith. And if someone tries putting you down, you're going to fight back. So these were the attitudes of the colonists. This is the attitudes of the founding fathers, that we can do it ourselves. We don't need anyone telling us what to do. And we don't want anyone telling us what to do. But even more perplexing is, how the heck did they win? If you ever have the ability or opportunity to study wars, usually the winners of wars, if you do a good analysis, are kind of obvious. So, for instance, in World War II, there's no way the Nazis could have won because the Nazis were fighting against everybody. And eventually, they would run out of men, just like they did in World War I. You know, Hitler was an idiot for starting the war. But here, everything was in England's advantage. England had the largest economy. England had the largest military. England had the largest navy. All we were a bunch of ragtag colonists with militia, farmers, who took up their arms. How did we win? Well, if you look at fair accountings of the War for Independence, there's three common reasons. The first is we had the epitome of the idealized leader, George Washington, the father of our country, rightfully recognized as such. While I don't believe that any man should be worshipped, Washington is close. Because his leadership is what got the country across the finish line. He was the original GOAT. Which is kind of weird, because he actually lost more battles than he won. So he wasn't the perfect military commander. But it was his persona. It was him, the man, that allowed us to win. Because he believed in the cause. And ironically, he was one of the wealthiest people in America. And he was willing to risk it all. His money, his estate, his land, everything. He was willing to risk it all. So if you're a small farmer and you volunteer for the militia and you see this guy who has everything willing to risk that for a notion of freedom, it's going to cause more people to sit back and say, okay, I'll give it a shot. Plus, while he wasn't the best military strategist, he loved his men, and his men loved him. He wasn't one of those leaders that lead from an office 100, 200 miles away. He was a frontline commander. He constantly walked among the men. He knew a lot of their names. He knew their wives, the names of their kids. He constantly asked them how they were doing. He was concerned. And ironically, year after year, when the militias commissions, because you would sign up for a year, you know, came to an end, many of them stayed on without pay because they didn't want to let him down. So, the fact that he was dedicated to the cause and he gained the respect of the soldiers, ultimately, this is what allowed America to win. Whereas, you compare that to Hitler, who I mentioned. You know, yeah, okay, they did create a cult, they did brainwash all the kids to make them little Nazis. But the vast majority of the German people did not love Hitler. They were terrified of him. And that's not a cause that someone's willing to die for. Reason number two, we had help. This hurts me. This hurts me so much. It pains me to admit. One of the reasons why we won is because the French helped us. Louis XVI, gave us loans, allowed us to use his navy, gave us weapons. If it wasn't for the French help, we would not have been able to win. And France helped us not because they liked us. No, it was the enemy of my enemy strategy. They hated the English. They wanted to see the English lose. So that's usually a good motivation. Humiliate your opponent. And lastly, speaking of their opponent, England. The English were not really committed to the cause. In order to fight a war, they had to control a war that was occurring 3,000 miles away in the days before the idiot boxes were invented. You couldn't just pick up the phone and call. Sometimes it could take up to 6 months for word to come over here and get back. So how are you going to control your commanders in the field? How are you going to know if they need supplies? You know, how are you going to run a war this way? You couldn't do it. So they made lots of mistakes. Second, they didn't control the countryside. You ever have the opportunity to study the War for Independence, you'll see the British would take possession of some of the big cities. Boston, New York, Charlestown. But the moment they tried marching into the rural parts, the militia would rise up and shoot them. So realistically, logistically, there was no way they could win. Plus, the English were not committed to the cause. There was no people signing up to get on a boat and come over here and fight to beat the Americans. Many of the soldiers they used were mercenaries. Germans, ironically. So if you're going to fight a war and you're not all in, there's no way you're going to win. So after Cornwallis surrendered, the British were willing to negotiate a settlement because they were absolutely convinced that the Americans would still have to do business with the English. Because are they going to do business with the French? And then what happened when they won? Well, an amazing thing occurred. First, states were created. Again, the name for our country
it really defines what we truly are. We're not a democracy, and we're not a unified country. Because which came first? The chicken or the egg? Well, it was the egg in the case of America. Because each of the colonies would declare themselves to be independent countries. And they would make their own governments.
Now, granted, some of the colonies kept their colonial charters, but others, like Massachusetts, scrapped what they had and made something completely new. And all of the ideals of the Enlightenment were enshrined in those constitutions. The Constitution of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, the oldest operating constitution in the world, ratified in 1781, creates a republic or a commonwealth. We have separation of powers, or three branches of government. There are checks and balances. There's a long, lengthy Bill of Rights that makes up the first 36 articles of the Constitution. And it's all based on the people voting. Popular sovereignty. Well, with those systems, right out of the gates, they were new. Because you know what? There wasn't? There wasn't nobility. There weren't nobles. There weren't special rights by birth. No, it was citizenship. And everyone would be treated the same under the law. And then in that first decade, an extraordinary experiment occurred. The founding fathers would make a government called the Articles of Confederation. We actually were a confederacy originally, where the states were more powerful than the national government. But if you studied American history, and hopefully you all got some, you should know that the articles didn't work. Because the national government couldn't control the states. They couldn't tax, they couldn't build a national army, they couldn't regulate the economy. So the founding fathers realized, okay, if at first you don't succeed, try again. They went back to work and they created the second national government under the Constitution of the United States. Which, literally, the first three words define who's in charge of this new country. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. We, the people, are in charge and the government serves us. John Locke, Social Contract. The national government was based on the model created by John Adams for our Constitution in Massachusetts. It's not a democracy. If anyone tells you we're a democracy, they are literally lying to you. We actually live in a republic. We don't make law. That's a democracy where the people make law. No, no, we elect people to make a law. That's a republic. And there's separation of powers. Congress, the presidency, the courts. There's checks and balances. Rights are protected because the Constitution limits the power of government. And the most amazing thing is, for a government, it's one of the shortest frames of government ever written. The original Constitution was on 4 sheets of paper. And it's only 4,543 words long. That's it. Christ, I've written blurbs on Facebook longer than that. Your paper, if you wrote a good paper, would be almost half of that. You know, it's not that long. But what it was done that way by design. Our Constitution doesn't make our government all-powerful. Rather, it limits the government to only do certain things. Of course, the problem is our people, our society, have become dumb in the last 250 years. And we've allowed our government to become overpowerful. And we don't do anything. We keep electing Democrats who want to destroy the Constitution, or we elect Republicans that don't want to protect the Constitution. It's our fault, so we deserve it. But I think at some point the American people will wake up. At least I hope so. Oh! And, as a compromise, because that was the thing, not everybody liked the Constitution. There were people in favor of it, and they were known as the Federalists, but there were people who didn't like it, and they were called the Anti-Federalists. But as a lesson to us, you had people of different opinions, and you know what they didn't do? They didn't try canceling one another. No, they worked together and they came up with a compromise. One of the biggest things that the Anti-Federalists didn't like was it didn't contain a Bill of Rights. So what does the first Congress do? It sits down and in the first days of the new government, it hammers out 12 amendments, of which 10 would be passed. And they protect the inherent uniqueness of the people from the powers of the federal government. Literally, the first 3 words of the first article of the Bill of Rights starts off with the 5 most beautiful words ever put on parchment. Congress shall make no law. The purpose of this is to keep the government out. And if you read the Bill of Rights, you will see how the Founding Fathers viewed every person as being unique. An individual, entitled by God with certain rights. So, what's in the Bill of Rights? Well, first, in the First Amendment, it states the government can't create a church. Because religion, religious thought, philosophy, is the power of the people. So no establishment, free exercise of religion. Because they believed religion is where your conscience came from, your morality. So they didn't want the government controlling your thoughts. They also, the third clause in the first article, free speech. You should be able to express your ideas. And there's a free press. You should be able to put your ideas in paper and let other people read it. And there's also freedom of association. You should be able to hang out with anybody you want. If you want to join Antifa, so long as you don't destroy anyone's homes, you should have a right to hang out with those crazy people. Or if you want to join the Ku Klux Klan and hang out with those crazy people, knock yourself out. It's not for the government to decide. Now, granted, I would not like any of you if you joined either group, because both groups are bad. But if that's what you wanted to do, you would have the right to do it. And, of course, you also have the right to grieve. You have the right to send an email to your congressman or your senator or the president and say, hey, look, I don't like what you're doing. In the First Amendment alone, that is the core of an individual. Free thought, your own ideas, your ability to express yourself. Well, what happens if the government violates the First Amendment? Well, that's what the Second Amendment's all about. The Second Amendment isn't just about going and buying an AR-15. No. The purpose of the Second Amendment is to allow we the people to be able to fight against the government if they intrude upon the First Amendment. Because that's literally what they did against their own government. When their government was intruding upon the rights of the people. And by the way, the Founding Fathers were against standing armies. Standing armies are loyal to the government, not the people. So that's why they wanted militias. And if the people should have a right to gather and fight against the government, well, they should be able to have the right to keep and bear arms. And by the way, don't believe the lie of the liberals. They were not talking about muskets. The Founding Fathers' view of arms was the same weapons that the military has. So if the military can have a machine gun, the people have a right to have a machine gun. Third Amendment, no quartering act. They didn't think it was right that people were being having to have soldiers in their houses. Fourth Amendment, the government cannot engage in unreasonable search and seizures. They can't break into your house and go through your closet. No. They need a warrant. No self-incrimination is in the Fifth Amendment. They can't, like the Inquisition, they can't force you in a chair and make you confess. No double jeopardy. If the government brings trial against you and they fail, they can't keep doing it over and over again. And they cannot deny you due process of law. The government has to protect, it says in the Fifth Amendment, life, liberty, and property. Sixth Amendment, if you're accused of a crime, you have a right to a trial by a jury, a right to an attorney, a right to a speedy and public trial. And most importantly, you have a right to know what the government's charging you with. And you can present a defense. Seventh Amendment, that's civil. So if you're going to sue someone for money, same basic things. Eighth Amendment, no Tower of London, no cruel and unusual punishments, and no excessive bails or fines. All of that was to limit the power of government to do to the people what the English kings used to do. To basically allow us as individuals to be free. And by the way, you want more proof that the whole goal was to limit the power of government? Well, that's the Ninth Amendment and the Tenth Amendment. The Ninth Amendment says just because something's not mentioned in the Bill of Rights, that doesn't mean it's not a right. God gives rights to the people, not government. And lastly, the Tenth Amendment. If the power is not specifically given to the U.S. government, then the U.S. government can't do it. It's to be left to the states or the people. So, before we go on to France, one last example. The whole controversy over Roe v. Wade. Well, the Supreme Court never had the power to legalize abortions. Because abortion is a medical issue. And there's nothing in the U.S. Constitution that says the national government has medical power. That's a state issue. You know why? Because if it's at the state level, the people can have a say. Whereas if it's a national issue, we don't. We should want everything to be at the state level. Now, will that mean every single state is different? Yeah. But that's the way it's supposed to be. And of course, if you don't like the way one state is, you can move. I know my plan is to get out of Massachusetts. I don't like living in the People's Republic of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts anymore. I want to get out. And I will be getting out as soon as my kids graduate from college. Because I can't live. I don't know how anyone can live here. Cost of living, taxation, it's unbearable. So I plan on going to a free state. Maybe Florida, maybe Texas. Although, Texas has bugs that can kill you. And that kind of scares me. I don't know, maybe Tennessee. We'll find out. Because that's what America's all about. If you don't like a place, you get up and move. Go live somewhere else. Maybe you'll have a better opportunity down the road. That's what America is. Questions? By the way, if you've never read the Constitution or the Bill of Rights, please do so. And please do so before you vote. Because if you listen to the politicians and you trust them to tell you the truth, you're fooling yourself. They want you not to know what's in there. So that's how I vote. If I hear a politician say something that I know is against the Constitution, they'll never get my vote. Ever. I vote only Constitution. Because that's what protects us from them. So in my humble opinion, we got it right. Unfortunately, this other revolution that will be the last bulk chunk of information for the semester, they, in many ways, got it really wrong. And proof of this, again, we don't have time because our class stops, but if you ever take Western Civ Part 2, I think I spent half of the semester constantly going back to France because they kept having revolution after revolution after revolution. They had like five revolutions all through the 1800s. And the funny thing is after every single revolution, they always ended up with an all-powerful dictator. At least until they got rid of Napoleon III. But the first revolution is what we got to talk about. The first revolution would begin just after we figured out the articles didn't work and we're going to have a new constitution. The first stage of the French Revolution really lasted for about a 3-year span, roughly from 1789 to 1791. Now, the funny thing is if they stopped here, France would have ended up with a constitutional monarchy like England. But they didn't. Now, what led to this revolution? Well, France. The way French society was. Structurally speaking, their society was based on the way it was throughout the medieval period. They had an aristocratic structure, which the French referred to as the old regime. Their society was based on rigidly defined classes, which the French called estates. In the first estate, there was the clergy. Obviously, these are the people that worked for the French church, which was a Catholic church. Now, all clergy were not the same. There was a distinction. The upper levels of the church, you know, the bishops, the cardinals, they were sons of nobles. And you could not become a bishop or a cardinal if you were a commoner who joined the church. If you were religious and you wanted to be a priest, you could go to seminary, but the most you could be is a monk or a priest. But, obviously, as men of the church, they had special rights. They didn't have to pay taxes. They didn't have to buy food. They didn't have to buy housing. All of that was provided to them. And if you assaulted a priest, you could be executed. They had special protections under the law. The second estate were the nobles. This was a closed class. You could never join the nobility unless you were born into it. This was a birthright only class. Now the funny thing is like the clergy, there was a division. There were some super powerful wealthy nobles, and there were some nobles that had the name, but they were poor. But regardless, they still also had special protections. The biggest being they didn't have to pay property taxes. And they could get government jobs. These two classes in 1789, roughly were about 4% of the total population. And at most, we're talking maybe about 400,000 people out of a nation that had 26 million people. Because the 96% were the commoners. Now, of course, there were two groups. There were the freemen, who were usually the artisans, the craftsmen, the merchants. And then there were the people who lived out in the countryside on the estates of the nobles, the peasants. Now, as far as the peasants go, they were not enslaved anymore. France did change this shortly after the death of Louis XIV. So if you were a peasant, you could actually leave the estate. But to live on the estate where you got housing and you got protection, you had to sign a contract. So you kind of became like an indentured servant. So it's not like they were enslaved. But 96% of the population were here. These are the people who had to work for a living. These are the people who paid all the taxes. These are the people that, you know, could have to be conscripted and have to go fight and die for their country. So right off the bat, you have a society that's not equal by any means. On top of that, their government didn't work. It was an ineffective governmental system. The biggest reason was that it made no sense. There was no constitution. There was no single code of law. Since France had always been a monarchy and the kings could make law, literally every single monarch who ever ruled in France made laws, and all of them were active. Including the laws where one king wanted to negate the laws of another, but then those laws were restored by another. So which ones do you follow? And there were big loopholes that basically allowed the nobles to get away with murder. It just didn't work. So what happened was is the judges would basically make decisions based on how they wanted the outcome to be. So there was no rule of law. There was no fairness in the system. Plus, to get a government job, all you needed was money. Louis XV made money by selling all of the government offices, which meant the nobles, the people who had the money, often were getting the jobs, whether or not they were qualified. Bless you. So the result was is you had incompetent government agents. So when you put it all together, it's no wonder why the philosophes constantly criticized the French government, because it made no sense. And it was bound to fail. And as if that was not bad enough, a lopsided society, a government that didn't work, and France had a lot of bills. France was like the United States today, in that it technically was a wealthy nation, but the government constantly spent more than it took in. I mean, seriously, what are we at right now? What's the debt clock at? Aren't we? I think we're like $32 trillion in debt. We're paying more money on interest on the United States debt than we actually pay to things like our defense, education, things along those lines. Because for the last, going back to, I guess you could say W. Bush, the government has been spending. I think when Bush came in office, I think the national debt was about $3 or $4 trillion. And then Obama came in and he doubled that. No, actually he tripled that, because when he left, it was about $12 trillion. And then Trump came in. He was doing okay up until COVID. But then the government started spending money like crazy. And then since Biden's been in office, he's actually outspent Obama and Trump combined. Well, if the government is getting us in debt, who's going to have to pay the bills? We are. That's the reason why Biden is proposing a $5 trillion tax increase. If you haven't heard it on the news, that's what he wants Congress to pass. $5 trillion in taxes. So all of the cuts that you got and your parents got when Trump was in office are going to go away. And everything is going to be taxed even more, which means the cost of living is going to go through the roof. Well, the same was true back then. France was a wealthy nation, but the government could not pay its own bills. In fact, it got so bad that when Louis XVI went to the banks and asked for loans, the bank said, you're cut off. We're not giving you any more money. And what was the problem? Well, the people who had all the money didn't pay the taxes. And the people who had no money paid all the taxes. So the system was as messed up as everything else. And then the king at the time wasn't exactly the best and brightest. Louis XVI, who became king upon the death of his great-grandfather, Louis XV. Maybe grandfather. I think it was grandfather. Now, Louis XVI gets a lot of blame. But truth be told, he was not dumb. A lot of what was written about him was propaganda that was written in the French Revolution, and it's not accurate. He was not dumb. In fact, truth be told, he was very intelligent. He had a photographic memory. He could speak fluently in, I think, 6 languages. He read the works of the Scientific Revolution and the Philosophes. But he was raised and taught not to speak. But rather, he was taught to listen. So as a result, whenever a controversy would brew, he didn't sit there and dictate what he wanted to have happen. No, he sat back and he just kind of listened to the room. But in a time of crisis, this made him look pathetically weak. So what happened? Well, like I told you, France was on the verge of bankruptcy. It couldn't get loans anymore. It couldn't pay its bills. So what does he decide in 1787? Well, we need to raise money. So what he proposed was a universal property tax, where everybody who owned land in France would have to contribute. Of course, the problem is 97% of the land was owned by the first or the second estates, the people who did not ever pay taxes. So when the king made the proposal, they, the rich, threw a temper tantrum. And they began to resist the king's efforts. Going so far as to say, we're not going to pay. And by the way, seeing how all of the government officials came from the second estate, they're not going to go to their parents' house and make their parents pay property taxes, no. There was a complete breakdown of authority. Then Louis got desperate. He did something that hadn't been done
since the reign of Louis the 13th, back in 1614. Louis would call what was known as the Estates General. Now, the Estates General was not Parliament. It was not a legislative body. It was an archaic system where the kings could call representatives of the different estates to look for advice. So basically, it was like a listening session. Because he hoped that he could convince the first and the second estates to pay something to help France. Because if France can't pay its bills and it goes bankrupt and it becomes insolvent, the country could rip apart. There could be chaos, there could be violence, it could be death. But the problem was the estates had their own agendas. So, when the call went out to send representatives of all three estates to the Estates General, all three estates responded. But the delegates for the first and the second estate, they're like, yeah, we'll go. But what are we going to do? We're going to take away the powers of the king, particularly the power of the king to tax. But the one thing the crown did not anticipate was the agenda of the third estate. The third estate had read the works of the philosophers. The third estate were knowledgeable in the events that gave birth to the United States of America. They read our Constitution. They read the Bill of Rights. They read the Declaration of Independence. And they started scratching their head. Yeah, literally speaking, God, the Creator, literally makes everyone the same. We are all created equal. We all pop out of mom's belly. That's biology. So if that's the way God designed us, men with the outies go into the innies and eventually 9 months later give birth, then that technically means we are all actually born the same. And if we're all born the same, should not we all receive the same rights from God? Well, if we're all entitled to the same rights from God, how can 4% of the population own 97% of the land and have all of the rights and the privileges? Well, 96% of the population have bumpkiss. That makes no sense. So what did the third estate want? Well, let's change things up. Let's equalize society. Questions? All right. So on May 5th, 1789, the Estates General would convene. They would meet in one of the palaces in the town of Versailles. Not the palace itself, but in the town of Versailles where the palace of the Louis is. The palace of Versailles. But Versailles is a town. And right across the street, I've been. It's very nice. Right across the street are big monumental structures. So the Estates General would gather there. And they would sit down and go to work. But right out of the gates, they had a problem. How were they going to vote on matters? Well, traditionally, there were only three votes that were cast. Everybody in the first estate would vote, and that the majority would be the vote of the first estate. So if all of the priests were for something, the first estate would get one yes vote. The same with the second estate. The same with the third. Well, the first two estates, who were the elites, wanted it that way. Because the church and the nobles were always going to vote together.
which means they always were going to win every single decision 2-1. But the third estate decided, no, let's let every individual vote. Let's vote by head count. The reason being was basic mathematics. To put pressure on the first and second estates, Louis, when he put the call out, did something that was never done before. Traditionally, everyone had about the same amount of delegates. They always were about 200, 225. So there would be 225 members of the clergy, 225 members of the nobility, 225 members of the commoners. But when he sent out the request, he doubled the amount for the third estate. So who showed up? He sent out 300, 300, 600. But who ended up showing up were 201 members of the first estate. Sorry, this is the second, 291, 294. So first, second, and third was 564. So right out of the gates, this really looks like they're going to lose 575 to 564. But here's the thing. The third estate knew that some of the priests were sympathetic. All they needed to do was to flip five. No, six. All they needed to flip was six seats. If six of these guys came over and joined with them, they would have a majority. So that's why they pushed for this. Well, there was arguing, there was debating, there was issuings, there was standoffness. But in the end, they did get a couple. In total, they got three priests, and much to their surprise, they got 11 nobles, which meant they were now 578 to 561. They had a majority. But still, the first and the second estate refused to participate. So the third estate shames them and says, fine, let's get rid of this estate's general thing where we all vote and act separately, and let's come together. Let's have a national assembly where we can work for the good of all people of France. And that's what the 574 ultimately decided to do. They left the Estates General, went to another building, and started meeting themselves. Questions? Well, I know I'm running short on time, so we'll keep it short and sweet. When the king got heard word of this, he was angry. Because he called them to do the Estates General, to do the traditional thing. And now they're going rogue. So, he actually called for a session known as a royal seance, where he was going to go and speak before the Estates General. But in order for him to speak before the Estates General, everyone had to get together. Well, this new National Assembly refused. So, the day before, the king was going to hold his royal seance, a shocking event occurred. The building in which the National Assembly had been meeting was left locked. and the representatives couldn't get in the building. Why? Well, the king never sent word to them that he was going to hold the royal seance. He only sent word to the first and the second estate. So all of these people had no idea what was going on. All they knew is on June 20th, 1789, they showed up and the doors were locked. So what did they do? Well, famously, they went around the back, they went onto a tennis court, and they took what was known as the tennis court oath. They pledged that they would continue to meet as the National Assembly until there was a new constitution. France had to become a constitutional monarchy, like England. Well, needless to say, this was not looked upon favorably. So, June 21st, the royal seance occurs. The king gathers in the hall. The members of the National Assembly get word that the king is coming, and they decide to go and listen. The king gets on stage, and the first thing he tells them is, you have to vote the way you're supposed to vote. You only can meet like the estates general, or I'm not going to listen. No one applauded. No one said anything. And then he's like, I heard about the demand for a constitutional monarchy. I may be willing to compromise. I may be willing to work with that. Got some applause. But you have to do it the traditional way. No applause. And then he ended with essentially saying, it's because I said so and I'm a king. Dead silence. King gets up and he leaves. In the room, an amazing thing occurred. A member of the second estate gets on the floor who had been a member of the National Assembly and basically said, we need to work for the rights of the French people. We need to take all of the power from that tyrant and give it to the people. And ultimately, that's what led a majority of the second estate to basically say, yeah, we will get more of what we want by working with the third estate than we will with the crown. Well, the king gets word of this, and this is basically a big F you to him. So he was not pleased. But you know what he did? He waffled. Instead of sending in the soldiers like Louis XIV would have done and shooting them all, he completely backs down. He tells them to make a constitution and he will sign it. And he ordered all of the rest of the nobility and the clergy to join. Well, this will be the last click, and I will pick it up on the video. At this point, the National Assembly would declare itself to be the legislative branch for France, and they announced to the people of the nation that they were going to now make laws to give every man and woman in France God-given rights. But of course, as you will hear when you listen, a whole bunch of stuff happened that kind of derailed the effort. Things got really radical. Wars began. And it would culminate in what's known as the Reign of Terror. So that's what I'll be talking about on the video. So, for those of you who came late, there is no physical class on Thursday. I have an emergency situation and I will be out of state. So I'm going to record a video and that will be an engage. Second, I screwed up the calendar. Our last day is not on Thursday. Our last day, or a week from Thursday, our last day is a week from today. So on that Tuesday, that's when your exam will open up. You'll have all day to do it. It'll open up at 8 a.m. and it will close at 11:59. Now, because I don't think any of you are seniors, if any of you are working on extra credit, you can send it to me as late as, I can go probably till Friday. I have to get the senior grades in by Wednesday next week. But I don't have to get your grades in, I think, until a week from Monday. But I want to have all my grades done by Friday, because then the following week I have chaos. So if you're working on those extra credit, I will take it up to that point. But you'll hear from me about your papers, then you'll take your exams, and that will be it. So hopefully you had a decent class. I know we covered a lot of stuff. History's hard. There's a lot of stuff that happens over the centuries. But hopefully you enjoyed yourself. Hopefully you learned a couple of things. I know you all like to be glued to your little devices and watch your little TikTok videos, but hopefully you actually are going to take away a couple of thoughts. And you'll be able to have a good life and stay out of trouble, no shenanigans. And who knows, maybe our paths will cross again. I hope so. So good luck on your finals, and hopefully we'll see you all in the fall.